Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. If you're a Philadelphia sports fan, you've probably read the work of Bill Lyon. Lyon covered the sports scene for decades for The Inquirer. He's now retired but still composes guest columns, his most recent a tribute to the late Arnold Palmer. But Lyon also writes about Alzheimer's disease because he has it, and he writes in spite of it. Diagnosed 3 years ago, Lyon is battling an illness for which there is no cure, not yet, but he's also trying to live fully and with purpose. As he puts it, my hope is that the columns will be cathartic and perhaps be of some help to anyone else who's going down this same long and winding road. We caught up with Bill Lyon recently, and here's the interview. Bill Lyon, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So tell us about Al.
Al is the character I invented to trying to put a face on Alzheimer. We know it's a terrible disease, that it has no cure so far, and it's undefeated so far. So I wanted something, you know, like the old Uncle Sam Wants You, a recruiting poster. And I thought we could find some vile, despicable caricature that we could... And we'll call him Al, short for Alzheimer. So in my mind, he was a runny, squatty, bandy-legged little gnome with a pot belly and a dead cigar stub sticking out of the corner of his mouth and a greasy Eagles shirt on top of his pointed little head. And I take great glee in putting it to Al whenever possible.
A greasy Eagle shirt.
Absolutely.
When you heard the diagnosis, what immediately came to mind?
I was sitting in the Penn Memory Center in one of those little cubicles they have, and the doctor, wearing a white lab coat, stood and asked me, "Do you know what Alzheimer is?" And I said, "It's death by inches." He said, "It is. And you have it." I thought that was rather blunt in retrospect, but at the time, what happened was I just went stone cold, frozen, for what seemed like forever. And if the world hadn't stopped, I would have been surprised. And so I said, he said to me, "What do you want to do?" I said, "At this point in time, I'd very much like to kick somebody in the ass, starting with Al." And so we began what's been an uplifting and humbling journey.
So you've been writing about this in a series of articles for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Yeah.
And you write in your words, "Adjust, adapt, concede nothing."
That's the mantra. And the other one is, "Resist, persist, never, ever give up."
Bill, you write frankly about losing your ability to drive, about issues like bladder control. How do you reconcile yourself to these developments in your life?
Well, after the diagnosis, I went through the usual routine of all who have been with that situation. The denials and the "oh, why me" and "pity me," and I thought, I can either curl up in the fetal position and go over in the corner and wait to die, or I could get up on my hind legs and beat the crap out of somebody. So I chose the latter, and I thought, if I'm going to be honest about this, then I shouldn't hold anything at all back, even if it's the times I've urinated or whatever else I've done. So when I went out, the time I got lost when I was walking and I ended up having to wet myself. And it may have been too graphic for some people, but I thought at least it's honest.
It's a reality.
Yes, it is. Somebody said that Alzheimer's is a family illness, because almost every family has a member that has Alzheimer's, whether it's a grandmother or an uncle, an aunt, or whatever. It resonates with people, I think.
You've had to get used to taking medicines.
Yes. My wife and I have been married 52 years now, and she's had a succession of medical maladies. And there was a point in time when she was taking, I'd sit there at the kitchen table and watch her take 10, 12 pills at a sitting. I mean, and we're a pill society, let's face it. And I said, well, this isn't any, I'll never do this. Well, yeah, I guess I am. I'm an obsessive compulsive anal retentive personality to begin with, so you can imagine what I'm like rationing out those pills.
But you're also exercising more, and this has had a positive benefit.
Absolutely. Walking is the simplest and the least expensive and the most effective exercise you can watch. It helps you cardiovascular-wise. I recommend now going up hills because that's good for the blood pressure lowering. And I try to walk 30 to 40 minutes a day, 5 to 6 minutes a week, 5 to 6 times a week.
But this can actually help to stave off the advancement of Alzheimer's?
Well, they say it does. They say between the exercising and the medication and above all your approach to it, that can help by the time that we need, because the two things that we need desperately are time and hope.
You write of your warrior woman.
Yes.
That's of course, your wife, Ethel. How important is support, family support, outside support, in holding Al at bay?
It's immeasurable. The first thing you learn about this is you're not alone. And I'm blessed with more than my middle linebacker.
Who is?
My Ethel. I always said of all the football players I ever covered, none of them was as tough as she was. She beat cancer 12 years ago now, and she's had all sorts of problems ever since. She's had 11 surgeries, and lately she's fighting severe emphysema. But she won't give up. So I'm not going to give up. We got each other. And then besides that, we have two sons, two grandsons, and one great-grandson. And they're all behind Pop-Pop.
You are continuing to work. What I last heard was that you're teaching creative writing at Delaware County Community College?
Yes.
How's that going?
Great. Well, the students might think otherwise. But I've been doing it for 5 years now. And when I first started out, I thought, you know, if I'm not going to be a writer, I might like to try teaching. And I've had the best of both worlds because I'm still writing and now teaching the class too. And it's because the impact a teacher can have on an individual. Sometimes bad, sometimes good, but it seems to me it's something that you'll carry through with your lifetime. I think we all have, so I'm just vain enough to think I've contributed something to somebody.
I have to ask this, where is Al? Is he in the classroom with you at times? Do you have to fight him off?
Al was going to come in the house, but the room became alive with electricity. And Al was chastened and hustled out the door, and he had to sit in the parking lot for 2 hours while we conducted our business.
You are going through a life change with your wife. You're moving from a home you have lived in for how long?
42 years. So as you can imagine, I know you and an awful lot of people go through this. I think it's one of the stages of the cross in your lifetime, and I don't call it house moving anymore. I call it uprooting.
Why are you moving?
I think the business, they call it downsizing. We went from there from an empty nest to an overflowing nest to a place where, even though I know it by the back of my hand, I still worry about dropping something, falling down, tripping. I've had two really bad tumbles in the last year. Fortunately, landed on my knees both times.
Is that part of your illness?
Yeah, because it's the depth perception is one of the things that goes with Alzheimer. And if I went to reach for your hand, I'd miss. And so that leads to dropped glasses, salad bar, you go, whoops, one fork full, and it goes over. And one of the things I had written about was forget ever trying to eat peas, because one of them will go down and you'll stab at it with your fork. And I said it reminds me of the Flyers on a mad rush up the ice.
You need your hands, obviously, to write, to type. How does this affect your writing?
Well, I was in my prime pretty fast. But that's the one thing that so far I've been... Al has, for whatever reason, has not invaded all of my brain yet, and I can still put words together, but the difference now is sometimes I have to read the same sentence three or four times, and to write it, I'll be in the middle of a sentence, and I'll forget what word was I was looking for. And I'll sit there gnashing my teeth. What the hell was it? I was saying it. I just had it. So I think the quality of the writing, if you'll pardon the ego, is still pretty good for a beginner. But it takes me a lot longer to finish now. What I could write in a half an hour before might take me 3 hours now.
How long do you plan to continue?
Till the day I die.
If a fan wanted to say, "How you doing, Bill?" what would your answer be?
Well, better than the alternative at this point in time. I'm, in a perverse way, I've been blessed. It's kind of late in life, but I think I found my cause. I think I found the one that I was maybe supposed to be put here for. And if that's the case, then I welcome it.
Bill Lyon, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Mary.
And just after the break, we talk about diagnosis, treatment, and caregiving. Stay with us. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. In the first segment of this show, we met longtime Philadelphia sports writer Bill Lyon. A few years back, Lyon was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. He's still writing, and he's doing so with grace and more than a little attitude as he struggles daily with a foe he admits will win in the end. So we're devoting the remainder of the hour to the battle, diagnosis, treatment, new drugs in trial, and caregiving. Jason Karlowicz is here with us in studio. He is co-director of the Penn Memory Center and a professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and Bill Lyon's physician. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you, Mary. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Felicia Greenfield is a licensed clinical social worker and director of care programs at the Penn Memory Center. Hello, Felicia.
Hi, Mary.
So, Jason, to you first. I'm sure you get this question all the time regarding Bill. He has Alzheimer's disease. He's published a series of columns on this huge personal challenge. So he's still writing professionally, and he has Alzheimer's 3 years in. How does he do it?
Great question. And, you know, let me just say that I think that, as I wrote in my essay about Bill Lyons in The Inquirer, he is a hero. And he's a hero because he has the courage to talk publicly about having Alzheimer's disease, candidly, with humor, and not the usual kind of some of the trite summaries I hear out there. He's educating and empowering the nation to learn to be able to talk about this disease and face it. He does have Alzheimer's disease. He has, though, an unusual presentation of it. He has what's called posterior cortical variant or visual variant Alzheimer's. So his earliest symptoms were actually troubles with what he just said to you, which is depth perception. And he actually wrote about that in one of his earlier columns in New Jersey Man. So his earliest trouble is, you know, not the classic problems with remembering new information, the repetitious questions, repetitious stories, which would certainly impair his ability to do his writing, but more troubles with, as he says, depth perception. You know, he's pretty good if I ask him to remember a list of words, but ask him to draw a clock and he'll hand you back that clipboard and say, it's not going to happen, Doc. Mm-hmm. And what, despite that unusual clinical presentation, the pathology is there, and as he said, it hasn't invaded all of my brain, but it has causing problems in the areas of his brain where it has invaded. And, you know, he describes other symptoms, for example, you know, I'm still writing, typing, but takes me longer to do it. Yes. You know, the column I could knock off in 30 minutes now takes me 3 hours. And so he's kind of a very typical story of in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease dementia, patients still retain abilities to do things, but it may take them longer to do them. And there are some things certainly that they can't do, such as in his case, for example, driving and managing finances.
So when a person has Alzheimer's disease, what is going on in the brain?
Alzheimer's disease is one of diseases that we call a neurodegenerative disease, a term that means that nerve cells, neurons, brain cells are dying. And the reason why they're dying is because there's a pathology in the brain. In the case of Alzheimer's disease, that pathology are two abnormalities that neuropathologists will look at under the microscope, amyloid plaques and tau tangles. There are other neurodegenerative diseases. Parkinson's disease is one, for example, Lewy body disease. Back to Alzheimer's, what's interesting, though, is that we're beginning now to be able to visualize, if you will, to see the disease's pathology even before we get brain tissue postmortem. Using PET scan imaging, for example, we can now visualize amyloid in the brain. And so it's firming up our ability to sort of sort out the box of the thing that we call Alzheimer's into more precise biomarker-based diagnoses.
So you can diagnose it earlier, and if you do that earlier, then get people into treatment and perhaps stave off.
Yeah, where we're at now clinically, meaning over at the Penn Memory Center, people can go visit us at PennMemoryCenter.org. You know, if someone comes in with cognitive complaints, cognitive impairment, we document it by history and testing. We have the ability now, using imaging and other modalities, to get pretty close to what the neuropathology is that might be causing that problem. Where we're not at yet is the ability to diagnose and label someone before they've suffered disabling cognitive losses like Bill Lyon. We'd like to get there, and we have studies going on right now at the Penn Memory Center that are designed to discover ways to diagnose and treat the disease before you're symptomatic. We're not there yet. We hope to be there. Our United States actually has a national Alzheimer's plan whose top five of its five goals, its first goal, is to effectively prevent or treat the disease by 2025.
Right. And before we go on any further, I'd like to give the number out in case anyone listening would like to get into the conversation, 888-477-9499, or you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at @whyyradiotimes. Felicia Greenfield, so Alzheimer's can be a rough ride, obviously, for the person who has the disease, but also for family members. And Bill Lyon, he spoke of his wife as his warrior woman. In a few words, characterize the typical experience for caregivers.
Sure. So Bill Lyons said in his interview with you that when he heard the diagnosis, it was like the world stood still. He made some reference to time stopping. And one of the caregivers that I work with made a similar analogy. She was with her husband when she heard the diagnosis, the words Alzheimer's disease. And she told me that she developed tinnitus at that moment, and it has not gone away since. So as you can imagine, hearing those words is a significant stressor on not just the patient, but on the spouse, partner and other family members who realize that the loss of the relationship that they once had is inevitable. It will begin to change over time as the person that they knew begins to decompensate because of the memory loss and other issues of Alzheimer's disease.
Do you recommend that right at the diagnosis, family members also seek out services?
We actually have something in place whereby the whole family comes in typically to hear of the diagnosis. And before they leave, they meet with me or someone from my team. And we kind of figure out where they are right now. Was this a surprise? Was this something they expected? What's going on at home? Is the patient supported? Does the patient live alone? And we kind of assess their understanding of what's to come and then provide customized information to them about the illness and how to prepare moving forward.
Do you find most people with Alzheimer's are able to stay in place for most of the course of the illness in their own homes?
I think that's the ideal situation, but every family has different you know, financial situations, different family makeups. So ideally, a patient will stay at home for as long as possible. And as the illness progresses, find other ways to support the patient, whether it's a day center or in-home care. And once that is no longer viable, then we look at alternative living arrangements.
Jason Karlowicz, what are the risk factors for Alzheimer's?
The studies since the 80s that have attempted to identify what are the characteristics of individuals or their environment that increase your likelihood of developing Alzheimer's show consistently that the more years of life you live, the more likely you are over time to develop cognitive impairment caused by a dementing illness, particularly after the age of about 70, 75. Having said that, we have identified certain common genes that increase one's risk, particularly what gene called the APOE gene. In addition, data suggests that overall cardiovascular health is associated with either increasing, depending on the cardiovascular health, or decreasing one's likelihood of developing cognitive impairment.
So if you're a longtime runner or cyclist or walker, you might have maybe less?
If your overall cardiovascular health has been generally good, their odds are you're going to be decreasing your likelihood over time of developing Alzheimer's compared to someone who doesn't have that. And we see this played out in studies that have looked over the 40-year incidence risk, if you will, of developing dementia, which is a generic term to describe cognitive impairment, which generally is caused by Alzheimer's, but other diseases certainly as well. And over the last 30, 40 years in the U.S. and other developed nations, we're seeing a decline in the risk of developing Alzheimer's. And we think part of that's explained by increased cardiovascular health as well as improvements in social and economic lifestyles beginning in childhood after the Second World War and the boom that occurred in Western economies.
And could you just quickly distinguish between Alzheimer's and dementia?
Yeah, great
in
question.
General?
Yeah, so dementia simply describes 12 or more months of progressive declines in cognition that are causing troubles doing daily activities, managing the finances, cooking a pie, things like that. What I then look for is what is the disease that's causing that dementia? Alzheimer's is one of the most common diseases. As I say, Parkinson's can cause it. Lewy body disease can cause it. HIV infection can cause a dementia. Dementia describes the severity of someone's cognitive impairments. Someday we hope to be able to diagnose Alzheimer's before you're demented. We're not there yet, but we'd like to get there.
Yeah. Are there early signs that maybe a family member can pick up on even before the diagnosis is made?
Indeed, that's what brings people in, that family members are picking up on something, and sometimes as well the patients as well, maybe not with the same severity and precision as the family members are. The Alzheimer's Association has the 10 warning signs I highly recommend. Just type in 10 warning signs and you'll find them online. Classic ones, though, are repetitious questions, repeating the same story, troubles with remembering the day of the week in particular. Is it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, more so than the date, if you will? Troubles performing some of the more complicated daily tasks of life, particularly managing money, medications, and transportation, whether that's driving or public transport. So here we are approaching Thanksgiving. Classic story we'll hear is that from the adult children who finally come visiting, mom used to repeat some questions over the last couple months on the phone. I just took it as whatever. But then we showed up for Thanksgiving dinner, and that well-organized, orchestrated dinner was not so well-organized and orchestrated. By January, they come in and see us, and generally the diagnosis is pretty clear.
And yet most older adults do have some memory loss. And is some of that normal?
Yeah, well, I don't know what the word normal means anymore when I think about aging. So with aging, meaning take away all diseases of the brain and study cognition over time in older adults, you will find declines. Highly variable, but you will find declines in what's called fluid intelligence, which basically describes the cluster of cognitive abilities that allow us to take in and process new information. Not all older adults experience this, but some do. And right now, we don't identify it as disease, but if we look under the microscope, we do see, particularly in animal models, changes in neuronal architecture and structure, particularly in frontal function. So cognitive aging is real. It's highly variable. Some have it, some don't. If you have it, though, and it's notable enough, you can start to have troubles with higher level tasks like financial management. Someday might we make this something we think is a quote a condition in need of diagnosis. I'll set that aside. I do think that if someone's having troubles with cognition, that itself needs to be assessed. Whether that's because of aging, neurodegenerative disease, or something else, that's to be sorted out when we come to the memory center or a similar place.
All right. I was going to say primary care physician, first stop, or?
Yeah, I think a perfectly rational strategy is start with your primary care physician who knows you well. I think we at the memory center probably are seeing a fraction, obviously, of the good work, because a lot of the good work done by our colleagues out there who say, this isn't something I quite understand and I need an expert opinion.
Felicia Greenfield, so, you know, we were talking about caregivers a few moments ago, and obviously there's a lot of stress and emotional upset. A recipe for burnout, and how do you prevent burnout when somebody starts to care for somebody who has an illness such as Alzheimer's?
Mm-hmm. So there's some data that supports the fact that when asked how long a caregiver thinks they'll be caring for somebody with Alzheimer's, the average answer is 2 years. And in fact, it's more like 7-8 years. So you're really, you have to look at this as like preparing for a marathon. It's not a sprint. And so when I am working with caregivers, we do a lot of coaching about self-care and the importance of taking care of oneself while they're supporting someone with Alzheimer's disease. In 2015, caregivers spent about $10.2 billion on their own healthcare-related illnesses that were either caused by or aggravated by caregiver stress. And so we encourage caregivers to make sure they're getting their annual physicals, making sure they're carving out time to be by themselves or be with friends, engage in self-care, get into therapy, join a support group, find ways to get out there and not self-isolate.
It's not always easy to ask for help, though.
Nope, it's not.
So what do you tell people? How do you advise them?
Well, we ask people to identify who is in their support network, and we actually role play in our caregiver classes about how to ask for help and in ways to negotiate with people in order to secure the help they need.
We've got calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Amber in Exton, Pennsylvania, you are live on Radio Times. Welcome, Amber.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just wondering if you have Alzheimer's in your family history. I'm 37 years old. My grandmother has it. Her grandmother had it. Her mother actually died of brain cancer very young. So what would be preventative things that, like, I'm 37, I'm younger, but what are some preventative things that people can do if you know that it is part of your family history?
Thanks for the call to Radio Times, Amber. Jason?
Hi, Amber. Yeah, it's a great question. What can you do when you're in your young middle adulthood to prevent developing Alzheimer's? And I think the answer to that is something that we're still working out. In particular, there are certain lifestyles that I think that the data support are beneficial. I think the question many people want to know is, well, you know, what pill should I take? And we certainly aren't there yet with what pill you should take, particularly at 37, where you would be in for quite a long time of pill taking. Having said all that, I think the data are pretty good that preserving and maintaining cardiovascular health, preserve and maintain neuronal health, brain health.
Crosswords?
I said cardio. I said exercise. So I'm talking about cardio, like what Bill Lyons is doing, climbing a hill. And notice how he even said that. I do it for 30, 40 minutes a day, 4 days a week. Not smoking. Treating hypertension. Treating hyperlipidemia. Not getting and or if getting adequately treating diabetes. There's good data that people who have a lifetime of, if you will, kind of chronic stress, kind of a chronic kind of, if you will, worrying glass half empty personality are more likely over time to develop Alzheimer's. And now to crossword puzzles. The data suggests that individuals who have led a life that is cognitively and socially engaging are more likely over time to not develop cognitive problems than people who didn't. How you define cognitively and socially engaging is a tough matter. Every study varies. In some sense, it's sort of getting at, like, it's good that humans flourish. And, you know, and I hope that when you look at the list I just gave you, you ought to be doing those things regardless of your concern about risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, given their benefits otherwise for health and also for just being a good human. I the thing that I find fascinating about Alzheimer's disease is, yes, it's a disease, but fundamentally it's getting at something about what it means to be a human and our humanity, and it's kind of making us reengage. So what is human flourishing, and what should human flourishing look like, not just in aging but across the generations? And when people start to become symptomatic, like Mr. Lyon, you know, what can we still do to preserve that humanity? And so I think, Amber, your question is a good entry into that broader conversation that we need to start to have.
We're talking about Alzheimer's disease. We're also talking about diagnosis, prevention, and caregiving. Our guests this hour, Dr. Jason Karlowicz, he is a co-director of the Penn Memory Center, and Bill Lyons, physician. Also, Felicia Greenfield is in studio with us. She is a licensed clinical social worker and director of care programs at the Penn Memory Center. We have lines open and calls coming in to 888-477-9499. Also, you can send us an email to Radio Times at WHYY.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Earlier this hour, we interviewed Philadelphia sports writer, now retired sports writer, Bill Lyon, who chronicles his journey with Alzheimer's disease in a series of columns for that publication. And also, we've got in studio with us his physician, Jason Karlowicz, who's co-director of the Penn Memory Center. Felicia Greenfield is a licensed clinical social worker and director of care programs at the Penn Memory Center. And again, if you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499 is the number to call. We've got a comment from Jay, which I find interesting. He says, I can't wait to get to know Bill a little better, meaning Bill Lyon. Jay says, I love that he calls his disease by a name. Bill calls it Al. And according to Jay, he says, I'm HIV positive, and I've always referred to my disease as Mr. HIV. I named him that because it rhymes with live. So, you know, Bill seems to be taking a control here when he's visualized and he's named Al, and the same for Jay, I'm guessing. And
I think what both Jay and Al are doing is addressing front on and center on one of the problems with having disease, and that is stigma. Namely, the belief once you're told a label that there's something different about you, and you think of yourself differently, and you fear that people will treat you in ways that are different. For example, not allowing you to be part of a friend group or discriminating against you. And certainly, Jay, you know, the story of the lives of individuals with HIV is the story of people coping with and overcoming stigma. And I applaud you for what you've done. And I think, and similarly, what Bill Lyon is doing is the same thing, which is he's front and center taking on the stigma and saying, I've got this disease. You know, the rhetoric around Alzheimer's is so red hot right now that I think, you know, it's a cancer, the plague of the 21st century, silver tsunami. I mean, it's just a pile on. You know, I think movies like Still Alice raised some awareness, but I think they also scared people. I could go on. And my point is this. I think having a patient talk about the disease with maturity, humor, and insight is what we need. We got to move beyond the Hallmark greeting card cliches. We got to move around beyond the sort of silver tsunami rhetoric that's scaring people. We've got to take this disease on as a disease of humanity.
Let's talk about promising treatments now in development.
Yeah.
Early last month, we heard of an antibody therapy trial, which might deserve to be called a breakthrough.
I'll give it a small B. Breakthrough with a small B. We'll get a capital B. Well, that will be pending the next clinical trial. So the drug in question was aducanumab. Never mind the name. It's one example of several drugs that are currently being tested in humans in experiments. And the theme of these drugs is that they target the pathology of Alzheimer's disease, in particular the amyloid pathology, the amyloid plaques, the goal being that if we can interrupt the accumulation, production, or speed up the degradation, clearance of amyloid, we might slow down neurodegeneration, change the natural history of the disease. And so the drug that made a lot of media, courtesy of a publication in Nature, of an early phase trial, is very promising. It is undergoing currently a validation trial. We're one of the sites for this study here. My colleague, Dr. David Wolk, the co-director of the Penn Memory Center, leads that study. It's one example of many studies going on in this space to discover treatments that target the pathology and would change the natural history. I'll conclude with the most exciting work in the space is using these drugs in individuals who don't yet have symptoms to see if we can slow down the onset of the disabling symptoms.
So with some of these patients in trial, there was an actual reversal in cognitive decline?
No. That if you look at the curve, if you take all the cognitive test scores of people on drug versus the cognitive test scores of people not on drug, follow them over time, the decline that you would expect was not as significant in individuals on drug. Again, it's an early phase study, meaning the duration of follow-up, the number of individuals, was not enough to let FDA say, let's approve this drug and I can write a prescription for it at the memory center. But it was enough to certainly say, let's move to the next phase of clinical trial, which we're doing now, along with many other sites in the United States, along with many other drugs, many. My advice to individuals who are interested in clinical trials around Alzheimer's disease is to visit clinicaltrials.gov, type in Alzheimer's, and you'll see what's going on out there. There's quite a lot of exciting work.
All right. To the phones we go. Cletus and Ben Salem, welcome to Radio Time.
Oh, thanks, Mary. Thanks for the call. As always, another great show.
Thanks.
I worked over, I was lucky enough to work over at a senior center in Saucon for a while, and then immediately after that, I worked for a private in-home caregiving agency here in Box, Florida. And I discovered along the way there, the director of the senior facility, when he saw my resume, he suggested I bring in some instruments, and I bring in a banjo or a guitar or a little Irish flute, and always a harmonica. And that seemed to brighten up or liven up some people in our extreme case ward, for want of a better description. And I thought, it seems to be working here. And then I left there and went to the private facility, and luckily they loved having me on board because my being a man helped them place me with a man that was one of their clients. And he had a banjo, and he was an old Navy guy, great guy, Harry Bowman. And I would play the banjo for him, and he'd get a kick out of that. That would calm him down. He wouldn't complain about us forgetting things all the time, or starting to. And I could even use my rudimentary Spanish during our exercises sessions. I mean, that must have brought something. He must have learned that in the Navy, I'm not sure.
Cletus, thank you for the call to Radio Times. We really appreciate that. Felicia Greenfield, music is medicine.
Sure is. When people are in the moderate to later stages of Alzheimer's disease, sometimes they lose their ability to speak. They lose language. And there are also some mood disturbances that can occur. And so when working with caregivers, one of the key topics is modifying the home environment and engaging the patient in things that they enjoy. And music is one of those universal things that everybody enjoys. And, we have seen patients who can no longer speak sing when we are engaging them in music therapy. There's a wonderful documentary called Alive Inside that really demonstrates the way music can help people not only manage a mood, but tap into past memories and regain some of that, their old personality.
Felicia, I'd also read that if you're going to take a loved one in who has Alzheimer's, prepare a segment of the house, a section of the house, so that it resembles the place in which they were living before. Does that work?
Well,
especially the bedroom area.
Yeah, I think that the idea there is to create the familiar environment. So if you're moving to an alternative living arrangement, to arrange the room, that bring the bed from the house and put it in the same position and arrange the furniture. And I mean, I think that just helps with orientation overall.
All right, we've got lots of calls. Joe in Ardmore, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call. The doctor kind of addressed it. Apparently in Japan, they're doing extensive research attacking the amyloid plaque using vasodilators. In other words, trying to get rid of the plaque in the brain arteries or blood vessels. Is there anything like that going on in America, and can you expand on that?
Thanks, Joe.
Yeah, I think the general theme I would say about the strategies, in emphasis on the plural, to try and develop treatments for Alzheimer's disease is one that targets amyloid production, clearance, or to degrade it. We also can see amyloid accumulate along the vessel walls of the blood vessel walls in the brain, small vessels. And there's a condition even called amyloid angiopathy. And it's interesting, the more we study amyloid with the imaging techniques we have, the more we're seeing a return of a prior definition of Alzheimer's, where you had to have amyloid angiopathy in order to sort of be diagnosed pathologically with Alzheimer's. All this is to say, I think the core message to Joe and others is what we talk about now when we talk about Alzheimer's is going to change in the next 5 to 10 years. I think we're going to carve out different forms of the disease based on our imaging and also the drugs and how people respond to them. It's going to be a very interesting world where I think the term Alzheimer's is going to start to lose its coherence as the sort of overall capturing term for the disease.
Can we use the word cure in there somewhere within the next decade?
I think, if you look at most, in a word, no, bluntly, because I think the more we understand Alzheimer's, the more we see its many things. And I think, you know, while I the ideas of hope resonate, I think we have to have a hope tempered by the fact that it's a complicated disease of aging, and like cardiovascular disease, like cancers, there are many routes into the house of Alzheimer's disease, and the notion that we could, quote, cure it is, I think, an ambitious notion. I think that our challenge for the next millennium, if you will, is how we're going to live with Alzheimer's disease, where we're able to now diagnose and control its natural history. It will no longer be like the winter that we just bundle up and stay warm from, and there's not much we can do about except stay warm. It will be more like something that we can manipulate and control. I think that gives us great opportunities to limit the burden of disability, but it also gives us great responsibility and some novel challenges about being able to control when and how you have the disease and how you treat it.
Continuing with our calls, let's go to Gail in Ocean City. Welcome, Gail.
Thank you, Marty. I have a comment. My mother had Alzheimer's, and I am a caregiver, a companion for people doing respite care. And one of the things that I've noticed over many, many years is that people who are older, people in their 80s and 90s, they grew up in a different age. We're in an electronic age, and I see people getting runned over, that people are their pace is so much greater that the elders are losing their confidence. I've also seen people misdiagnosed with Alzheimer's and dementia. When I watch them, they're oriented to present and past. They know their medications. They know how many numbers they take. But their family has been told that they have Alzheimer's or they have dementia. And pretty much, I think, their pace is just slower, and no one's giving them an opportunity to go at their own pace. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make a comment and hear what the professionals say about this.
All right. We appreciate the call to Radio Times. Jason Karlowish, how do you know you've got the right diagnosis?
We're no different than Alzheimer's in 1901 when Klaus Dieter brought in August Dieter and said, you know, she's not cooking food like she used to and she doesn't recognize me. August Dieter was quite severe when at that time she was in classic severe stage disease. Bottom line is we're no different than in 1901. A good, careful history. And then after a careful history of not just from the person who has the cognitive problems, but from people who know them well, cognitive testing, an exam, and then as needed, imaging or other tests. I can't emphasize enough the value of that history. And I think one of the problems I see out there is clinicians simply do not have the time and the space to not just interview one but two people. And I think one of the challenges is also the skills that are needed to get that kind of history, and recognize sometimes that you just don't have adequate history from the person who you're trying to find out what's going on with this other individual whom you're concerned mm-hmm. about their memory. Look, I think we got a lot of work to do here in the space of Alzheimer's disease to get an adequate workforce in place to diagnose and treat patients. I'm not surprised, Gail, that you're seeing people who very well are misdiagnosed. We don't have the same kind of workforce we have in place for cancer and oncology as we should have and need to have for Alzheimer's disease.
And yet, as the population ages and that aging population grows, maybe that'll change.
It has to change. I wrote recently in my column on Forbes, you know, Alzheimer's disease patients are the last casualty of the Cold War. If you want to know why things are so bad as they are now, you got to look back to what was happened and didn't happen when we created Medicare in 1963.
Let's get to an email from Cora who asks...
65, by the way.
Okay. Email from Cora who asks, how can I support my family member from a distance? My father has a difficult time asking for help, and when I've asked him in the past, he hasn't been able to identify how I can help. So two questions there, Felicia Greenstein.
Sure. That's a tricky situation, the long-distance caregiver. And I think that if the simplest answer is to find they used to be called care managers. Now they're called aging life care specialists. And they are professionals who you can, from a distance, contract with. And these individuals will go to your parents' house and assess the situation and make recommendations about how to keep the family safe.
We've got an email from Phyllis. As we head to the top of the show here, Jason Kollerich didn't mention dietary choices that are better for preventing, delaying Alzheimer's. Mediterranean diet, is that something that can help in prevention or something like the Mediterranean
diet? Yeah, in a word, yeah. Remember, though, look at the map, look at the Mediterranean Sea, and you know there's a lot of countries around it, so what diet, et cetera. But the bottom line is we think that a cardiovascularly healthy diet is a diet that is associated with brain health, and it probably has to do with reducing the incidence and severity of cognitive aging. So when you lay the pathology of Alzheimer's onto healthy neurons, they're more likely to function than if they're not so healthy. So in principle, yes, the Mediterranean diet. I think that's more compelling data than the data, for example, around the use of supplements, which I find to be very uncompelling. Remember, diet is associated with lifestyle, and lifestyle is associated with socioeconomic status. And so these things start to bundle together. I think it harkens back to the data that show that over the last 30, 40 years in developed nations, dementia incidence has been decreasing. And I think it reflects not a treatment for Alzheimer's disease, for example, but rather improvements in the quality of our lives, education, Social Security, and reduced cardiovascular risk factors.
And Felicia, I wanted to get to one quick thing. Obviously, when you're talking about caregivers, we think of individuals, but there are often whole families involved. How do children and teens often react to a loved one's diagnosis, and what's your advice there? Bring them into the conversation.
Children and teens are affected in different ways. The emotional impact on a teenager, if we're talking about somebody who has early onset dementia and still has teenagers at home, these individuals need a lot of support. So I would recommend getting that person in to see a therapist or a psychologist. And there are some support groups for young adult children of patients with young onset Alzheimer's disease.
All right. And as we close the show again, Jason Kollerich, if somebody thinks perhaps they've got a relative who might need some help or an evaluation, step number one is what?
Step number one is to have them see their doctor, the doctor who knows them well and has been caring for them. Based on that, take it from there.
All right. Jason Kollerich, thank you so much for joining. It's great to have you here.
Thank you so much, Mary. It was a pleasure.
And Jason is a co-director of the Penn Memory Center, professor of medicine, medical ethics, health policy, and neurology at the University of Pennsylvania's Perelman School of Medicine, and Bill Lyons physician. And Felicia Greenfield, a pleasure as well.
Thank you, Mary.
Felicia Greenfield is a licensed clinical social worker and director of care programs at the Penn Memory Center. And this reminder, if you head to whyy.org/radiotimes, you'll find our Facebook page and podcasts. Let us know what you think and become part of the family here at Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening.